All right. Welcome, everybody, and good day. Today is another day with our New Matter podcast. We get to interview really cool life science luminaries here. I'm your host today, Liz Frank, our SLAS program manager. Today, I'm chatting with Colleen Janczak. She's from Scintillation Nanotechnologies. Scintillation is going to be one of our Innovation Avenue companies at SLAS 2022, our international conference, which is taking place in February in Boston, USA. We're really excited to be able to meet Scintillation for the first time, I think, possibly, as an SLAS audience. And this podcast is a great opportunity for us to learn more. So welcome, Colleen.
Thanks very much. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. So I'm gonna start you off with our SLAS challenge of telling me a little bit about what Scintillation does in 10 words or less. And then I promise I'll let you go into more detail later.
That is a challenge. 10 words or less. So Scintillation Nanotechnologies makes nanomaterial detectors for radioisotopes. And I realize that's less than 10 words, but I think that's about
10 words or less. So you kept it really short. You might even win the prize for exactly how few words you use. I'm going to let you expound on that a little bit. So can you tell us a little bit about what Scintillation does and kind of how you guys got started?
Sure. So our products are meant to detect low energy radioisotopes. And while that sounds kind of scary, radioisotopes are oftentimes used as molecular labels. They're pretty common, actually, in biology and biochemistry experiments as well. And that's because you can take a molecule that you're studying, for example, and just kick off one of the atoms and replace it with a radioactive hydrogen, for example. So you could replace a hydrogen with a tritium, and now it's labeled. So our nanomaterials are for detecting those labeled small molecules. And so when scintillation occurs, that tritium on your little molecule will decay, and then our material will absorb some of that energy and emit light. So you can measure the light and trace that back to how much of your labeled molecule you have. And in that way, you can trace how much you have and where it is and where did it go and some other things as well. It's really sensitive. So really using radioisotopes is one of the most sensitive ways to detect small molecules. Our company got started, I think we started on paper in 2018, but we didn't really get to get into actual operations until 2020, which was really not the best year for starting operations for a startup company. So it's been extremely challenging, but we have gotten rolling. So we have our lab space and we're working on continuing development and production and working with our collaborators for product acceptance.
That's really cool. And yeah, I can fully understand how trying to build a startup and getting launched, you know, in the public sphere during a pandemic can be super challenging. When you're at 2022 on Innovation Avenue, what's you just described a little bit of what you guys do, but what is it that you're going to kind of try to pitch to people who come by to see you? You know, what is it that you want them to collaborate with you or buy from you or learn about you? Like what's kind of your little pitch to them?
So what we would like them to learn from us is how we can help them in their bioassays. I think radioisotope use is in a lot of cases kind of on the back burner. A lot of companies use them because radio labeling something is very sensitive, but you don't hear about it very often, but it's there because it is so sensitive. And so for one thing, while we're on Innovation Avenue in our booth, we're really, really looking forward to just meeting people, really, not over Zoom and not by telephone and certainly not by email, because it's just not the same. But to be able to talk to them and find out what they're doing, understand their problems, see how we can help if we can help with our detectors in their processes. And hopefully, you know, if they find a connection that maybe we can help, then we can move from there. And I think the more people we meet, the more we can learn about how we can help.
Yeah. And that's one of the really great things about Avenue. It's right there in the middle of the show floor by the big name booth. So you'll get a lot of foot traffic and really get to connect and network. A couple of more science-y-based questions. So I'm kind of curious, are there any uses of radioisotopes that happen in everyday life that, you know, maybe people wouldn't normally think about?
Well, you mean like science in the kitchen kind of idea.
Maybe, yeah. Hopefully Karen, like, so for, I guess a lot of our audience are scientists, obviously, but a lot of our audience might be engineers or tech, or wouldn't necessarily fully understand what it is that you're working on. So maybe kind of give a general example that might be able to kind of help them wrap their head around it.
Okay. I'm a lot of radioisotopes, not necessarily isotopes that we detect, you can find, for example, you would find them maybe in your, a common example is a smoke detector would have americium in it. A lot are naturally occurring. So you can find this in some places in minerals and other, like just out in rocks, but it's very low level, I think. A lot of the radioisotopes that one would use in a laboratory setting, you would purchase not from us, but from another company. And I'm trying to think of where that would come into your daily life.
It might not, you know, it might not come into the everyday person's daily life.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you can find, you know, sometimes radioactive potassium in small levels in glass and bananas. And I know for a long time, people were searching for these certain glazes on pottery that would, I think they contained very low levels of radioactive material. And so that was kind of exciting. I don't believe that pottery is made anymore. So now they're both interestingly radioactive and maybe antique at this point. But
those are some pretty good examples. So I guess kind of going back to specifically what you guys are trying to do and the collaborations that you're trying to make. I know that you said you've just in 2020 kicked off. So you're only about a year old, but can you tell me about a time that you maybe give me an example of when, you know, scintillation has helped with, you know, a researcher answer a research question that might have been challenging for them in the past, you know, maybe helped them figure out a solution to something that in the world of radioisotopes, or do you have any cool stories with regard to some of the research that you've been doing around that?
Sure. Yeah. So one thing I do want to tell you is that we do actually have products ready for use and for sale. So we do have products. They are available for purchase for anybody who's ready to start using them. We have customers as well. So we have made some small sales. And so even though we continue development, we do have developed products already out and ready for use. One of the most interesting areas we think, and maybe more promising, is the use of radioisotopes and our small particles for what are known as scintillation proximity assays. So in a scintillation proximity assay, you have your radio-labeled molecule again, and you're maybe watching a binding event. So you have a receptor or something like that that is binding this small molecule. And it's hard, we'll say, it's difficult to detect because if you change that small molecule that you're studying by adding a fluorophore or by labeling it in some other way, you've changed what that molecule is like and how it diffuses and how it binds to the receptor and some other important factors, characteristics about that molecule. So instead, you've decided to radiolabel it. And now you're looking for this receptor and small molecule binding event to occur. You want to know how much does it bind? How quickly does it bind? You know, what's your KD, what's your on-off, like all of these other factors that are really important if you're studying this, for example, developing a new drug. You need to know all of those things in order to find out how that new drug would work and can it work and at what level does it work. But the added complication here is that oftentimes those receptors can be a bit unstable. So there are proteins, for example, and you purify them. Sometimes if they are not, or if there are proteins that were originally expressed in the cell membrane and you take them out of the membrane, they no longer fold in the same way that they did when they were in the membrane, or perhaps they no longer function in the same way they did in the membrane. So the best thing to do actually is to keep it in a membrane-like environment, and then it will fold in the same way. And so if you can keep those proteins in that membrane-like environment, which with our products you can, and then watch that binding event occur. So when that small molecule comes and binds to that receptor, you can see an increase in the signal. So now you know it's bound. And so you can monitor binding this way with really fragile proteins. And we've had some of our collaborators, they've been able to do this with their membrane proteins, either in lipid nanodiscs or detergent micelles, which is a way of stabilizing these really delicate membrane proteins. And so for us, that's really exciting because this is really, these are difficult to study to start with, but then that they can use our products to study this and then also get a better signal versus their background than they can by other methods is extremely exciting to this. For now they can see the binding occur where before they would just see the background signal of their experiment. And so they couldn't really tell if it was binding or not. And so that's where we get really excited is when they find, when we get to the point where we've been working with our collaborators and they're like, I can see it now. And that's really so exciting for everybody. And so that's one of our primary goals. I know it sounds kind of strange, but once somebody says, I can see it now, then we know that we've gotten to the right place.
That's really cool. So, yeah, absolutely. So getting to the see it now definitely is a really cool, you know, eureka type moment. My next question is regarding receptors, which don't maintain their native conformation. It's really cool that your research was able to ensure such a stable environment. Can your products also help identify the instable receptors? Like, is that what you were saying, that they're able to
differentiate between those that are, that's not something we've thought about. Actually, that's not something we thought. Maybe it's something we should think about.
Maybe something you should do. So who are the people that are going to be the primary, you know, I guess, users of your technology? Is it going to be academic researchers mostly or industry, pharma? Is this something that high schools and colleges might be interested in taking advantage of for their advanced programming? Like, who's kind of the intended audience in terms of the purchasing of the product?
We think mostly academia and industry, probably not colleges and high schools, because simply because it's radioactive material you would have to work with. So you have to have the licenses in place, and you know, you have to make sure you know how to dispose of your waste appropriately and all of these things. So that kind of rules them out a little bit, although that would be, I think it would be really interesting to connect with high school and college students. I think radioactivity a lot of times gets that scary kind of vibe to it. And so it's like, oh, it must be bad. I mean, in many cases, it's naturally occurring as well. So it's also a tool. So, yeah. And a very, very valuable one at that. But sorry, to get back to your question, yes, I think mostly it's academics and industry. And so we think this could be really useful, not only in academic research for identifying, not just studying binding events and studying receptors and studying any other radio-labeled experiments that people can think up, which they do. They come up with some really fabulous and fascinating experiments that we just haven't thought about before. So it's always super interesting talking to them. But we also think there's a place for this in place and studies for maybe screening, where you would need to have a sensitive assay and just, you know, for example, on a multi-well plate, fill those wells and test all of these different small molecules with a certain receptor or something, and just do it until you have that data and you can be sure that it is or is not binding, and to what degree is it binding, and do that very sensitively and reproducibly. And so we think there's a space there for our products as well.
All right, cool. Well, I think you're going to have a great opportunity to talk to all the different groups that you want to kind of pitch this to. So that'll be awesome. Kind of going off the science aspect a little bit, I like to ask our startup companies, especially since you're so young, you guys, you know, I know you were on paper in 2018, but you really kind of kicked off last year. What was the most exciting moment for your company, you know, since you started? Like, what was the thing where everybody just started screaming for joy that, you know, you had either rolled out your product completely, or you had completed your first paper or whatever? Like, what was that kind of thing that everybody in the company was like, oh, we did it? Can you share that for us?
I think for us, it was probably our first official sale. And that's because you can talk to collaborators and so many people are so very kind and they're willing to help and give you ideas, and they'll try your product and maybe it will help or maybe it won't help. And so there's a lot of back and forth there. But then when somebody finally says, I need this and I'm going to give you money for it, it sounds very, I don't know, it sounds very negative in a way, but it's also very validating. Somebody needs it and they're willing to give us money for it, to send it to them because they really do want it. That was for us really important and was a good indicator, I think, that we're headed in the right direction.
Yeah, it's a great validation. And you're not the first startup company to give me that answer. So that first sale, I think, is always a big, you know, woohoo moment.
Yeah, it's less about the money and more about knowing that you have done something that it's like, yes, somebody does actually need this. I'm not just, you know.
Yeah, it's proof of concept like that, like it's actually wanted. It's actually desirable. So I'm kind of going to start wrapping up with a few questions asking your advice for future startups, future generation scientists. I guess I'm going to start with the future generation scientists, because you did bring up earlier that, you know, there tends to be a lot of maybe negative reactions or negative connotation around working, you know, with radioactive material or radioisotopes. So, you know, what's kind of your advice to future scientists or even startups that are interested in learning more about this field? Is it just don't be afraid, or is there other advice you want to give them?
I think it's that using low energy radioisotopes, like the ones that people do use in lab, tritium, S35, P32, a lot of these, they are very low energy. They can be an extremely powerful tool. And I mean, lots of tools can have risk associated with them, but that's the case with many things. And so I think if there's any hesitation, or if this is something that can further your research, just reach out to people that do use them, have used them in the past, or, you know, email us. We're always glad to talk about it, and to anybody who has questions. And there are, and it's always hidden in the details. Like you go down to the methods and you find out that somebody has actually done this really beautiful plot of binding, and they did it using a radio assay. It's in there. It's there. And so find that person and ask them, how did they do it and why did they do it that way? Scientists are generally extremely excited to talk about their research. So probably they would be very, very happy to tell about how they did that experiment and what went right and what went wrong. But I think, yeah. Are you also talking about younger science, like up and coming science?
High school students? So when I say younger generation scientists or emerging scientists, we're often talking about not necessarily the high school level, but I include them too in my mind. But, you know, we have a lot of undergrad and grad level scientists who are kind of, especially the undergrad, who are trying to figure out where they want to go, if they're going to go into grad school, kind of like what field to like really focus on. And I always like to kind of end with giving them some advice.
I see. Okay.
But I think the advice you gave them, or you just gave, is pretty applicable to them as well, as, you know, reaching out. I mean, I'm going to just put you on the pedestal there. Colleen knows a lot about this, and she's super passionate, people. So I'm sure she'd answer your questions.
But I sure don't know everything. I reach out to other people all the time and just send emails and say, I don't understand this. Could you talk to me for a few minutes? And I would say it sounds really risky, right? Because you're reaching out to somebody you've never met and asking them a question. But most people will respond, and they're really happy to talk to you about something that they might know a piece that you're missing. Yeah. And then so you talk, and then, oh, now I get it. And then you can move on to your next step.
Well, I like the conference for that reason, because we have everything from, you know, undergrad to postdocs trying to share info and asking questions back and forth. And it's really just cool to be able to give that opportunity. I had so many more questions, but like we are kind of running a little short on time. So I guess I will ask my two kind of last questions for now, and then see if you have any final words. Kind of going back to your company a little bit and who, you know, would be accessing your products. You mentioned the fact that your core customers are academia and industry. With that first sale, with the people who have needed your products, is it usually people on like the individual researcher level, or have like department level labs, like full labs, been kind of interested in it? Is there a trend in one way or another, or is it kind of a mixed bag?
We've found so far that it tends to be full labs, like full academic labs. So that, and you know, like a PI at a university will be working on a series of projects. Maybe some of them are related, some are not, but usually there are numerous people within that lab who are doing similar things. And so usually once we start talking to someone within a lab, they'll say, oh, the other person in my lab is doing something similar, maybe they want to talk too. And so we'll keep talking and talking, and oftentimes it's several people within the same lab that are interested.
All right. Well, that's pretty cool. Also good to know, because we do have lab memberships. So you know, it's good for the lab levels to understand. So is there anything that you want to kind of close out with regard to additional information we may not have touched on? You know, this is a short podcast, so I'm sure there's a ton Scintillation's doing, but, you know, where can they find you? Is there anything exciting you want to share that I didn't ask about? Are you guys hiring? You know, what would you like to kind of let the audience know about before we close?
Please come see us on Innovation Avenue. Even if you're just curious, stop by and talk. If there's some aspect that is not clear, we'll bring out the diagrams and the Sharpie markers and the whiteboard and start drawing pictures. And if you have an idea, stop by. If you're curious, stop by. We'd just be glad to talk to you. So we're really extremely excited. This is our first conference in person, and this is our first exhibition. So this is our first booth. And so this is really a big step for us. And we're excited, and we're already planning what kind of materials we'll have and all these details. But we'd be glad to talk to anybody even if you're not doing any radio assays and just have some thoughts, come by, talk to us. Somebody will always be there at our booth. So
that sounds fabulous. I know I'm going to stop by, and I'm not even a scientist, but I really want to see all those pictures and diagrams because it looks really cool. All right, we're going to close it out. But everybody, you know, who's listening today, do make sure to stop by and see Scintillation Nanotechnologies at the Innovation Avenue. You know, I think that the Avenue companies might be one of the stops along the Passport for Prizes. So check that out. We want to make sure that, you know, they get a lot of good foot traffic and that you get to, you know, contribute to what they're doing and give them feedback, especially since, you know, it's their first year doing one. So it'll be a really cool opportunity for them to learn how to, you know, really network in a big show like this. So thanks again for Colleen for joining us today. We were really happy to have you, and I'm really excited to see Scintillation in just a couple of months. It's going to be an awesome show.
Thank you very much for inviting me. And yeah, I was really good to talk to you.
Yeah, likewise. All right. Have a great day, everyone, and see you on the next New Matter.